Welcome to a special edition of All Sides with Ann Fisher. The individual mandate survives. The Supreme Court has upheld the heart of President Barack Obama's health care overhaul, ruling in favor of the requirement that most Americans can be required to have health insurance or else pay a penalty. The decision means the historic overhaul will continue to take effect over the next several years, affecting the way countless Americans receive and pay for their personal medical care. The ruling also hands President Barack a potential campaign season victory. Coming up, complete analysis of the landmark decision continues. With us in the studio, Peter Shane, Jacob E. Davis, and Jacob E. Davis, the second chair in law at The Ohio State University's Moritz College of Law. Peter, once again, thanks for joining us today.
Glad to be here.
And WOSU News Director Mike Thompson's in the studio with us as well. Maybe talk a little bit of politics. Welcome to the show, Mike.
Thanks, Ann. Good to be here.
The politics of it. What does it mean? I mean, does it really hand the President Barack Obama a campaign season victory? What do you think they're out there?
I think it's a if the Supreme Court, now that the Supreme Court has upheld at least the heart of the law, it is certainly a victory for the president. That's obvious. I think it's a bigger victory for the president than it would have been if the Supreme Court had struck it down. It would have been that would not have been as large a victory for Mitt Romney, simply because, you know, Mitt Romney had this exact same plan, more or less, in Massachusetts. The president could have campaigned saying, yeah, they struck down my law, but they struck down Mitt Romney's law as well that he wanted to bring nationally. So certainly it is a big victory for the president. Now, and it's funny, the expectation game in politics. After the oral arguments, every pundit out there was saying there was no way that this was going to be upheld based on the questions from all of the justices. There was no way they were doomed. This was going to be the entire Obama presidency was going to crumble because his landmark legislation was going to be struck down by the Supreme Court. Well, it teaches everyone not to listen to the oral arguments and the questions from the justices. So now the expectation was it was going to get repealed. Well, it wasn't. So this is kind of like, to use the sports analogy, an upset win, which is an even bigger win for the president. But as you saw with Mitt Romney, his banner, it was already pre-printed. They probably had two banners printed, repeal and replace Obamacare. It's actually the repeal and replace. The verb should be switch, because he's going to have to replace President Obama and then repeal Obamacare. But you know right away what Mitt Romney is going to campaign on. That's what Republicans are going to campaign on. And it could be effective because Americans are still pretty split on this health care package and what it means to them. The fact that the Medicaid has been struck down, that puts burden on states.
Or the expansion,
right? Yeah, the expansion of Medicaid, that puts burden back on the states. And Republican governors like John Kasich, who I don't think we haven't heard from yet, are going to use that against the president. Ohioans are split on this in polls. They overwhelmingly rejected the president's health care plan in 2010 in the election on question number, I forget which one it was.
One of those three. Yeah, it was three. Only three.
So it remains to be seen, but certainly today is a win for the president and you could say an unexpected win.
The decision is a very big victory for President Obama. He is going to be speaking from the White House approximately quarter after, but we're standing by. We will air his comments when they come live on 89.7 NPR News. Peter Shane, what about those oral arguments? A lot of people were caught off guard, but people who have watched the Supreme Court for many, many years knows that statistically speaking, the oral arguments aren't necessarily a big indicator.
Right. Interestingly, I had the privilege of attending an event this past spring where former Justice Stevens was speaking. And Justice Stevens basically urged the crowd assembled to take exactly the wisdom that Mike just offered, which is don't regard the oral arguments as good predictors of which way the court is going to go. Cases, in terms of argument, the briefs weigh more heavily. The oral argument may be a good window into how the justices are trying to influence one another. They're the first opportunity, perhaps, for each justice, if they are so inclined, to share with other justices what they regard as the strong or weak points of a counsel's argument. I think what took people aback about the oral argument, however, was first of all the tone of Justice Scalia's questions, which seemed to be more more argumentative and less analytic than might have been expected from a justice. And when Justice Kennedy said to the Solicitor General, "Doesn't the government come forward with a heavy burden to support this law?" It's conventional constitutional doctrine that the burden in a piece of constitutional litigation falls on the challenger to the law, not the government to uphold it. So this, particularly for those of us who expected Justice Kennedy to be the swing vote, I think this is what sent up some, signals of alarm.
You know, Mike, Maurice Thompson from the 1851 Center for Constitutional Law says they were very disappointed in the Chief Justice in him siding with the with the liberals in this case.
Yeah, that's the
Chief
big
Justice John Roberts.
That's the big surprise. I mean, anything more surprising would have been if Antonin Scalia had sided with the president. But there, I forget which appeals court judge it was or appeals court panel, very conservative. I believe it was in Virginia. Upheld the law. So the conservative judges, appeals court judges have upheld this.
And elsewhere, there was a couple conservatives.
If I could just make a local pitch here, the opinion I think you're recalling is the Sixth Circuit. Uh-huh. And the conservative judge who wrote an eloquent concurrence upholding the law was our proud alumnus, Jeff Sutton.
Jeff Sutton, former the Attorney General. Now I'm just blanking out.
I'm sorry.
For the state, he was the...
State Solicitor?
Solicitor General,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Judge Sutton is philosophically conservative. He takes a generally conservative approach to constitutional issues. He's very careful, very analytic, and I think genuinely open-minded. And he offered what I thought was the most straightforward rationale for upholding the law, which is that the mandate really could be looked at as basically a prohibition on self-insurance, that everyone has to make a decision with regard to how they're going to handle their healthcare needs. You can buy insurance or you can self-insure, and there's no reason from the point of view of economics why the decision to self-insure should not be viewed as a commercial decision, and it's one that very substantially affects the national economy in a way that a decision whether or not to forego broccoli does not. Mm-hmm. So I guess I had expected the Supreme Court to follow Judge Sutton's reasoning.
I've heard some analysis today saying that now that the Commerce Clause has been sort of taken out of the equation by the court's decision, this is in fact a tax, that the Republicans will use that to say President Obama is going to raise taxes on folks who make less than $250,000 a year, which would break his no taxes on those folks pledge. Frankly, I think that's a bit of a stretch. It just took me 30 seconds to explain that. It's not going to work too well, I don't think, in a it could work in an ad, I guess, because like anything works in a political ad. But that's a tough sell. I think what most people hear today is that President Obama's plan was upheld by the high court, and a very conservative justice, the Chief Justice, sided with him.
Kevin Holtzberry, president of the Buckeye Institute for Public Policy Solutions. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
What is your reaction to the, it surprised a lot of people to the decision by the U.S. Supreme Court today?
Yeah, I think it was a surprise in the way the decision was made. And I think people are still trying to digest what it means in terms of the court's jurisprudence. In terms of politics.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. The decision is a very big victory for President Obama. He's speaking now from the White House. We're going to go to his comments right now.
Passed 2 years ago. In doing so, they've reaffirmed a fundamental principle that here in America, in the wealthiest nation on earth, no illness or accident should lead to any family's financial ruin. I know there will be a lot of discussion today about the politics of all this, about who won and who lost. That's how these things tend to be viewed here in Washington. But that discussion completely misses the point. Whatever the politics, today's decision was a victory for people all over this country whose lives will be more secure because of this law and the Supreme Court's decision to uphold it. And because this law has a direct impact on so many Americans, I want to take this opportunity to talk about exactly what it means for you. First, if you're one of the more than 250 million Americans who already have health insurance, you will keep your health insurance. This law will only make it more secure and more affordable. Insurance companies can no longer impose lifetime limits on the amount of care you receive. They can no longer discriminate against children with pre-existing conditions. They can no longer drop your coverage if you get sick. They can no longer jack up your premiums without reason. They are required to provide free preventive care like checkups and mammograms, a provision that's already helped 54 million Americans with private insurance. And by this August, nearly 13 million of you will receive a rebate from your insurance company because it spent too much on things like administrative costs and CEO bonuses and not enough on your health care. There's more. Because of the Affordable Care Act, young adults under the age of 26 are able to stay on their parents' health care plans, a provision that's already helped 6 million young Americans. And because of the Affordable Care Act, seniors receive a discount on their prescription drugs, a discount that's already saved more than 5 million seniors on Medicare about $600 each. All of this is happening because of the Affordable Care Act. These provisions provide common sense protections for middle-class families, and they enjoy broad popular support. And thanks to today's decision, all of these benefits and protections will continue for Americans who already have health insurance. Now, if you're one of the 30 million Americans who don't yet have health insurance, starting in 2014, this law will offer you an array of quality, affordable private health insurance plans to choose from. Each state will take the lead in designing their own menu of options. And if states can come up with even better ways of covering more people at the same quality and cost, this law allows them to do that too. And I've asked Congress to help speed up that process and give states this flexibility in year one. Once states set up these health insurance marketplaces, known as exchanges, insurance companies will no longer be able to discriminate against any American with a pre-existing health condition. They won't be able to charge you more just because you're a woman. They won't be able to bill you into bankruptcy. If you're sick, you'll finally have the same chance to get quality, affordable health care as everyone else. And if you can't afford the premiums, you'll receive a credit that helps pay for it. Today, the Supreme Court also upheld the principle that people who can afford health insurance should take the responsibility to buy health insurance. This is important for two reasons. First, when uninsured people who can afford coverage get sick and show up at the emergency room for care, the rest of us end up paying for their care in the form of higher premiums. And second, if you ask insurance companies to cover people with pre-existing conditions but don't require people who can afford it to buy their own insurance, some folks might wait until they're sick to buy the care they need, which would also drive up everybody else's premiums. That's why, even though I knew it wouldn't be politically popular and resisted the idea when I ran for this office, we ultimately included a provision in the Affordable Care Act that people who can afford to buy health insurance should take the responsibility to do so. In fact, this idea has enjoyed support from members of both parties, including the current Republican nominee for president. Still, I know the debate over this law has been divisive. I respect the very real concerns that millions of Americans have shared. And I know a lot of coverage through this health care debate has focused on what it means politically. Well, it should be pretty clear by now that I didn't do this because it was good politics. I did it because I believed it was good for the country. I did it because I believed it was good for the American people. You know, there's a framed letter that hangs in my office right now. It was sent to me during the health care debate by a woman named Natoma Canfield. For years and years, Natoma did everything right. She bought health insurance, she paid her premiums on time. But 18 years ago, Natoma was diagnosed with cancer. And even though she'd been cancer-free for more than a decade, her insurance company kept jacking up her rates year after year. And despite her desire to keep her coverage, despite her fears that she would get sick again, she had to surrender her health insurance and was forced to hang her fortunes on chance. I carried Natoma's story with me every day of the fight to pass this law. It reminded me of all the Americans all across the country who have had to worry not only about getting sick, but about the cost of getting well. Natoma is well today, and because of this law, there are other Americans, other sons and daughters, brothers and sisters, fathers and mothers, who will not have to hang their fortunes on chance. These are the Americans for whom we passed this law. The highest court in the land has now spoken. We will continue to implement this law, and we'll work together to improve on it where we can. But what we won't do, what the country can't afford to do, is refight the political battles of 2 years ago or go back to the way things were. With today's announcement, it's time for us to move forward, to implement and, where necessary, improve on this law. And now's the time to keep our focus on the most urgent challenge of our time, putting people back to work, paying down our debt, and building an economy where people can have confidence that if they work hard, they can get ahead. But today, I'm as confident as ever that when we look back 5 years from now, or 10 years from now, or 20 years from now, we'll be better off because we had the courage to pass this law and keep moving forward. Thank you. God bless you, and God bless America.
That's President Barack Obama speaking from the White House about the U.S. Supreme Court's decision today. U.S. Supreme Court, once again, for those who are just joining us, upheld the heart of President Barack Obama's health care overhaul, ruling in favor of the requirement that most Americans be required to have health insurance or else pay a penalty. Two things he said. Today, the Supreme Court also upheld the principle the people who can afford health insurance should take the responsibility to buy health insurance. And also, he reiterated or itemized the array of benefits. And that's the first time I've heard him do that with such a large audience.
Yeah, I think he has. I don't think the message has got through. But you look at the speech. It was roughly 8 minutes long. It wasn't until 4 minutes into the speech that he talked about the individual mandate, which is the most unpopular aspect of this law. He started with the laundry list of things that are popular, the doing away with of the pre-existing condition denial of coverage. That affects millions of people who cannot change their insurance or buy insurance because of a pre-existing condition. Young adults being able to latch on to their parents' policies until age 26, very popular. Rebates from insurance companies. Who doesn't want a rebate from their insurance company if they've paid too much? Then he gets to the individual mandate, and he frames it as a matter of fairness. It's not fair that folks can go to the emergency room without insurance, get coverage, and the rest of us pay for it. And he snuck in there a little dig at Mitt Romney, saying this is the one part of the bill that he supported, at least on the state level in Massachusetts. So just the structure of the speech, it shows you he has a bit of a tough sell on the individual mandate still, but he laid out all the popular aspects of this.
And then
law.
He played the ultimate political card in saying, I didn't do this because it's good politics.
Yeah. And at the end of the speech, he says, now it's time to focus on the economy. And this ruling allows the president's campaign to focus on the economy. Now, he may not want to if it doesn't improve, but had the law been struck down, he would have spent the next 4 or 5 months defending his administration's push for a health care overhaul during the first 2 years of his administration when the economy was still struggling. Republicans would have hammered him on that. Now he can say, yes, I did that. It was the right thing to do. A conservative Supreme Court agrees with me. So he doesn't have to defend himself on that anymore. A conservative Supreme Court has defended his law. He can now focus on what it will be, ultimately, the big issue, the only issue in this campaign, and that's the economy.
Kevin Holtzberry, president of the Buckeye Institute for Public Policy Solutions, reaction to the president's speech and the U.S. Supreme Court ruling.
Well, I think the president was being pretty disingenuous to some degree. And I think that shows that what's probably going to happen on the campaign trail is we'll be having a policy argument more about the technical details of the policy and their implications for the average voter as opposed to a large-scale constitutional question. I do think that is something that is going to have to be discussed because from our perspective, there are a lot of really disastrous policy implementations going on in the Act that weren't likely to be decided by the court anyways. And so I think that's where we need to get to, is a debate about how to provide coverage and quality care and to lower costs. And I don't fundamentally think the Affordable Care Act is moving in that direction.
So you say the conversation will occur outside of the Affordable Care Act?
No, I think we need to have a debate about whether the Affordable Care Act is going to do what the president claims it is going to do, which is provide more coverage, better care at less cost. I think that is fundamentally not true. And so that's the debate we have to have. Instead of is it constitutional, we need to have a debate about will it actually accomplish the goals that the president and its supporters say it will, and if it does not, what are better ways to do that? And I think that'll become a political debate, obviously, in a campaign season and with Congress pushing to repeal and replace. But from our perspective as a state-level think tank, that's the debate we want to have anyways. We need to have a debate about health care reform that focuses on what provides quality care, lower cost, and greater access to care. And I think I don't think the Affordable Care Act does that. So I think to some degree that the court has kicked it back to the court of public opinion and the role of public policy and politics and democracy, and that's where we need to have those debates and make those decisions.
The president just issued a laundry list of what he says are the benefits of the Affordable Health Care Act, and I'm wondering, in terms of a debate, how do you respond to those? What are what's the laundry list of disincentives to?
Well, I think a great example of that is the president continues to insist that people who have care they like will keep it, and I think that is just fundamentally not true, because the way that particularly with the court decision now, it's just a tax decision, right? So let's say a company, under the current circumstances, provides health care to its employees. And to do so, to bring on a new employee, will cost the company $6,000 to offer health care to that employee. It turns out that under the new system, they can drop coverage for their employees, pay a fine of $2,000 to $3,000 per employee for not offering. But no, I'm sorry, now it's not a fine, it's a tax. Pay a tax on each employee for not offering insurance. You don't have to be an economist to understand if the cost to offer health care is $6,000, the tax to not offer health care is $2,000, the company is going to take the tax, and those people will be then forced into the state-level exchange and into the government system. So I think those kind of decisions need to be made so that public understands that this is a pretty radical reorientation of the market, and that it does not reduce cost, it does not increase access in practice, even though if it promises greater access statutorily.
Mike, do you think, I mean, are those the kind of issues that are going to be emerging in a useful way during the campaign?
Yeah, one of the main criticisms of this of the overhaul is the cost factor. It really, the critics say it did not do really anything to control costs. I mean, there are some caps on Medicare reimbursements that the hospital association, medical associations are upset about. The hope was that by putting people on insurance, making them get insurance, that fewer people would go to the emergency room for basic care, which would lower cost. But there's no mandate that certain procedures will not be covered by the law, and certain expensive procedures, or that hospitals have to cut the cost of CAT scans and MRIs and things like that that are very expensive. And that is a thing to watch. I mean, because you don't know. One thing it does do, though, for businesses is we've heard for months now there has been uncertainty since the law passed, and it was immediately challenged in the courts. Businesses didn't know what to do. They didn't know whether they should bring on extra employees to face. Then they would have to buy that offer health insurance. The Supreme Court's ruled now, so that level of a certain level of uncertainty has been removed. And Republicans will try to repeal it, but you got to keep in mind, even if Mitt Romney wins the presidency, and the Republicans hold the House, and Republicans win back the Senate, the chances of Republicans gaining 60 seats.
Which is what would be required.
Which is what would be required to really overturn the law. That's very remote. So I think there is a certain degree of certainty now that this is the law of the land for the next, well, unless there's a major shift in the political atmosphere in Washington.
Kevin Holtzberry, what do you agree, disagree? I mean, that a repeal is really going to have that much impact in the long run, since it could be vetoed and not, the veto couldn't be overrun, probably?
Well, I think, frankly, that expectations were too high going into this from the conservative side to begin with. Politically and policy-wise, this is always going to be very difficult work to bring true reform and to overturn many of the components. I think many conservatives were hoping that a more clear-cut repeal would give them the space and the momentum to do that kind of thing, and this ruling clearly does not. In the short term, it may turn out to be a much stronger bulwark against government power on the Commerce Clause side, but in the immediate political impact, it is going to be a long, hard slog. It always was going to be the case. But I do think there are some strong political elements that can be used. The tax element, I think, is one that Republicans generally play too well, that Democrats are going to increase your taxes and spend it on things that will not improve your lives can be a very effective political argument. I think the other thing that is going to bring political pressure to bear is this is a system that is trying to increase supply or access to care without creating more supply. If you're going to bring on 32 million more people into the healthcare system without any significant ways of increasing the capacity to handle that, you're going to see wait times increase, costs go up, and a lot of problems develop, I think, over the long term. That is the kind of thing that could bring an impetus to real change and could be something that the politics will switch over the next couple of cycles, and we could see a very different atmosphere down the road.
Mike Thompson?
Yeah, the problem with that is absolutely right. I mean, we won't know, and there could be some things that people don't like. But as this decision now clears the way for this law to be fully implemented, and starting in 2014, the pre-existing condition clause kicks in, where adults with pre-existing conditions cannot be denied coverage. Other popular aspects of this law will be implemented, and it's going to be tough politically for lawmakers to take that away. You could tweak it around the edges, but the same debate happened with Social Security and Medicare when they first were enacted and approved and then upheld by the courts. Once people got used to them and liked the security that Social Security and the Medicare provided, they are really, you know, untouchable. They could be tweaked, they could be reformed perhaps, but they're not going to go away. And this could happen with this healthcare overhaul as well.
Kevin Holtzberry, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Appreciate it. Kevin Holtzberry, he's president of the Buckeye Institute for Public Policy Solutions. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The Supreme Court upholds most of President Obama's Affordable Health Care Act. The Supreme Court has upheld the individual insurance requirement at the heart of President Barack Obama's health care overhaul. In a 5-4 ruling, the court this morning rejected that Congress went too far in requiring most Americans to have health insurance or pay a penalty. We've heard from President Barack Obama. Right now, we've heard from several analysts, including just heard from Kevin Holtzberry, the president of the Buckeye Institute for Public Policy Solutions. Still with us in the studio, Peter Shane, professor of law at the OSU Moritz College of Law, and also Mike Thompson, news director at WOSU. Joining us now, Dale Butland, co-chair of the Ohio Consumers for Health Coverage. Dale's also with Innovation Ohio. Welcome to the show, Dale.
Hi, Ann. How are you?
Good. You sound happy.
I'm not just happy. I think that all Americans should be happy, because now as of this morning, the promise of the ACA, namely that no one in this country is going to have to go bankrupt because of medical expenses, is now going to bear fruit.
The president went through a laundry list, as we mentioned earlier, of all the benefits of the Affordable Care Act. It seemed like he hadn't done that much before.
Well, I think that's right, Ann. I think what the decision today by the Supreme Court does is it allows those of us who support the ACA to do a reset, as it were. We've done a lousy job in explaining to the American people and to the people of Ohio, in this case, as to what this law will do, why it's important and why, for example, you've got to have the individual mandate if you want to make insurance companies cover pre-existing conditions. It's been real interesting to me that when you look at the public opinion polls, in fact, the most recent one I saw showed that like 62% of the people did not like the so-called individual mandate. But that same poll showed 80% of the people wanted to make insurance companies cover pre-existing conditions, which tells me that nobody has explained adequately yet to people why you can't have insurance companies required to cover pre-existing conditions if you don't have everybody in the insurance pool.
U.S. Senator Rob Portman today issued the following statement regarding the U.S. Supreme Court ruling on President Obama's health care mandate. He said it's actually a multi-billion-dollar tax on middle-class families. Is it now a tax hike on the middle class? Is that how it's going to play, 4 months, moving through the next 4 months into the presidential election?
Well, you know, in some ways it's kind of sad that the Republicans now, having tried all of their other arguments, which got shot down in a conservative-dominated Supreme Court, are now falling back on one more, and they want to play the tax card now. I think at some point you've got to say that the time for politics has passed. No wonder public opinion of Congress is at an all-time low. It just seems that once again, congressional Republicans are proving they have no interest in bipartisanship. They have no interest in working together on behalf of the American people. It seems to me that now that the court has ruled, the time for politics has passed. It's time now for Republicans and Democrats to work together on behalf of the American people and the land we love. But that apparently is not going to happen at the congressional level. Let's just hope it works here in Ohio. I mean, let's hope that Lieutenant Governor Taylor, for example, stops dragging her feet now and starts setting up the health insurance exchanges that are required by law.
Or the federal government will step in and set up the exchange itself.
Well, yes. But Lieutenant Governor Taylor in the past has said, well, the reason that she was turning down all this money that the federal government was providing to states to help them set up these exchanges is because she said, well, it's unclear what the court's going to do. We don't know. So we don't want to get into this until the court rules. Well, now the court's ruled. So it's the law of the land. And let's get out from behind the eight ball now, and because I think surely Ohio wants to set up its own exchange. We don't want to have the feds do it for us.
Once again, I'm talking with Dale Butland. I misspoke. Dale Butland is Communications Director for Innovation Ohio. Sorry about that, Dale.
Quite all right. It's not the worst thing I've been called.
We're going to hear from a listener. Rich and Bexley, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Ann. I just wanted to call in response to something I heard from the gentleman from the think tank, Kevin.
Kevin Holtzberry, yes.
Would now do a cost-benefits analysis that if it was $6,000 to cover their employees or a $2,000 fine, they would opt for the fine rather than the coverage. I mean, under the old system, you never had to insure your employees in the first place. You could have just saved all $6,000. I don't understand where the logic is that now employers are going to begin to drop their insurance plans. There's also the value to them of retaining their employees with health insurance. If they were just to be, I mean, there's almost less of a benefit to dropping health insurance than there used to be. Would you not agree?
Well, I don't. Let's hear from Dale Butland. Dale, what do you make of that? He says did you hear?
Ann, it was cutting in and out, so
okay.
I didn't hear the whole thing.
That the idea that people would, something, a point that Kevin Holtzberry from Buckeye Institute made earlier, that if it's more economical, companies would just drop insurance coverage for their employees. Rich and Bexley is saying, well, they don't have to provide insurance now. So if they're not doing it just because it's bottom line good for them, they're doing it because they think it's the right thing to do. It's an enticement for good employees and that sort of thing.
Yeah, well, maybe we ought to talk about for just a moment, Ann, because maybe a lot of the listeners don't know why it is that our country is the only industrialized country in the entire world that ties health insurance to employment. No other country does that, and we only do it because it's a historical accident. Back in World War II, we had a labor shortage in this country because most of the men were off fighting the war, and yet we had wage and price controls on, which meant that companies who wanted to hire new workers, needed to hire new workers, couldn't offer them higher wages because there was wage and price controls. So they came up with the idea of health insurance as a benefit. And then the IRS came along and helpfully decided that they weren't going to tax this fringe benefit. So that's how it was that we tied insurance to employment. So the same rationale applies now. Companies that want to hire good people want to have a good benefits package to attract those people. But I also think this is just my own personal feeling that, you know, at some point it becomes unfair to corporations. If we're the only country in the world that requires companies to cover the cost of health insurance, it really does damage our ability to compete, which is why I think that a Medicare for all or a single payer system is a better way to go. But maybe that's an argument for another day. Right now, what we know is that this law has been upheld. And if I could just say one last thing, just before I came on the air with you, I was watching Mitt Romney in his comments, and of course, the Republicans are talking about repeal and replace. And Romney said, well, let's talk about what we Republicans are going to keep when we replace it. Now, remember, they've had 2 years since they've been shilling this mantra of repeal and replace, repeal and replace. Well, right now, they've got no replacement. They got no plan right now. But he says, we want to make sure that people with pre-existing conditions have coverage. Well, as we just talked about a moment ago, you can't do that if you don't have the individual mandate, because people will wait until they get sick to buy coverage. And when that happens, your pool gets sicker and sicker. The costs go up. Premiums go up for healthy people who after a time drop out of the system because they can't afford the higher premiums, which means your pool gets sicker and sicker and more expensive for the companies. So it's just silly to say that we want to make insurance companies cover pre-existing conditions, but we don't want the mandate.
Well, Dale Butland, I want to thank you for joining us today.
And it's always my pleasure.
Dale Butland, Communications Director for Innovation Ohio. Mike Thompson, is there ever an end to the political debate? That's one of the things that stuck me from Dale's comments.
Well, Dale kind of went down a path. And Dale Butland is on my show, Columbus on the Record, a lot as well. He went down a path that Democrats probably need to be a little careful about, is that he says this isn't the end. This is the first step towards Medicare for all, which truly is a government takeover of the healthcare system. That is something that I think most Americans right now do not want, or at least are not comfortable with. And if Democrats start saying this is maybe the first step towards that, that could be used against them. So I think that Democrats are probably going to have to be careful in saying, you know, this is, like President Obama said, this is, nobody's going to go without health insurance anymore. No one's going to go bankrupt because of a health care crisis. To say this is the first step towards health care for all, government-funded health care for all, that will not work in the Democrats' favor.
Peter Shane.
Yeah, just listening to what Mike said, the thing that struck me about Mr. Butland's remarks was really the historical point. And that is, again, you know, whether the Affordable Care Act is or is not good policy, or single payer is or is not good policy, single payer or Medicare for all was the traditional progressive position. What is now being called Obamacare was traditionally the conservative Republican position. And I do think it will be interesting to see as part of this debate what is going to fill in the blank on the repeal and replace sign in terms of a replacement. Because as Mr. Butland said, and I've never understood as a legal matter why the government did not more aggressively defend the law simply as a way of making it practical to require insurance companies to insure everyone without regard to pre-existing conditions.
Ohio, led by Attorney General Mike DeWine, was one of 26 states to challenge the health care law. Attorney General Mike DeWine is with us now. Thanks for joining us.
And thank you very much. Good to be with you.
You said that in your statement earlier today, while we lost the battle over Obamacare, we did win the war on the true meaning of the Commerce Clause. Was that a big enough war to make too much over?
Oh, I think it was very, very important. you know, the great fear that we had, and many of us had, is that the Supreme Court upheld this law based on the Commerce Clause, that that would set a precedent for future cases, which of course it would, and that there would be no ability, frankly, to limit the power of the federal government. I think it was expressed very well by Justice Alito when he asked the government's solicitor, what is your limiting principle? In other words, if we uphold this based on the Commerce Clause, what is the limit of this Commerce Clause in the future, and is there a limitation on what the federal government can do? By a 5-4 vote, the Supreme Court today said this does would violate the Commerce Clause. Now, what of course the big surprise was on the tax provision, which five justices accepted, including the Chief Justice, who turns out was the swing vote. And what's interesting is the Obama administration, of course, denied that it was a tax, said initially it was not a tax, although later in the court they argued that it was a tax. But when they were getting it passed in Congress and trying to convince the American people it was good, they said it wasn't a tax. And then the lower courts who looked at this, I think virtually every one, if not all, the lower courts that looked at this did not buy the argument that it was a tax. But today, the five people who really count, they decided it was, in fact, a tax, and therefore the law is constitutional.
We just received a statement from Governor Kasich and Lieutenant Governor Mary Taylor on the U.S. Supreme Court healthcare ruling today. He says, "We're very disappointed that this flawed law has been allowed to stand. The Supreme Court has confirmed what everyone knew all along, but that the White House tried to deny. This is a massive new tax on the middle class." He said the administration will carefully analyze the decision to determine the appropriate next steps. "We are very concerned that a sudden dramatic increase in Medicaid spending could threaten Ohio's ability to pursue needed reforms in other areas, such as education." You led, as I said, the Ohio become one of the 26 states to challenge the health care law. Do you know how much we spent on that fight, and was it a good use of Ohio tax dollars?
Yes, it really was. We spent $10,000. Basically, the states pooled their money to hire Paul Clement. I think it was money very, very well spent, because the other part of the decision today, which is not getting quite as much attention, is the Medicaid decision. And in that decision, the United States Supreme Court said that the federal government, and I'm going to paraphrase now, in essence, cannot blackmail the states. And they cannot say to the states, "You must accept our new Medicaid expansion, and if you do not, we will take away your money from the old Medicaid program." So the good news for Ohio and other states is we won on that provision. Now it's going to be up to the governor and the legislature and the state of Ohio to determine, you know, what they do in regard to Medicaid. That's not my decision. That's their decision. But they now have, based on this decision, something they did not have yesterday, and that is the freedom to make a decision about whether they accept the new Medicaid provision or not. If a state does not, although the federal government picks up a lot of that, it still costs the state a lot of money as well.
Lieutenant Governor Mary Taylor has said that up until at least today that they're going to wait and see how the U.S. Supreme Court rules in this case before they start working on the health care exchanges and those sorts of things for Ohio. Of course, each state has the opportunity to develop their own health care insurance exchange. What's your recommendation? I mean, what is your sense about whether or not Ohio should go forward and do that for itself or wait and have the federal government step in?
Well, I'm not going to make policy recommendations. If the question is this a settled legal question, the answer is it is a settled legal question. Now, the only thing that would change is if Congress, under a new president and a new Congress next year, would repeal the law. But until then, or if that occurs, this is the law, and we need to follow the law.
Attorney General Mike DeWine, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Ann. Thank you.
Ohio Attorney General Mike DeWine. We're going to continue our coverage now. Once again, if you're just joining us, you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. It's a special show. The Supreme Court upholds most of President Obama's Affordable Health Care Act. The Supreme Court has upheld the individual insurance requirement at the heart of President Barack Obama's health care overhaul. In a 5-4 ruling, the court this morning rejected that Congress went too far in requiring most Americans to have health insurance or pay a penalty. Once again, as Attorney General Mike DeWine brought up, and we will reiterate it again, that there is a They did not uphold the automatic or mandated expansion of Medicaid benefits that the state would have to provide. It'll be up to the states to decide whether or not they want to avail themselves of those federal funds and expand the Medicaid coverage. Peter Shane, you've been flipping through OSU Moritz College of Law professor.
It's like the Manhattan phone book over here. Yeah,
right. It's a Supreme Court decision. 198-page decision. Anything that you're looking for right now as you shuffle through those papers?
Well, what I was looking for, first of all, I was feeling some sympathy for friends of mine who are co-authors of edited constitutional law casebooks. We'll have to figure out how to boil this down into something you could assign to a student without stirring stirring up a classroom revolt. But what I was looking for, the state attorney general speaking about the Medicaid provision, said, you know, it was very important that the court indicate that states couldn't be blackmailed. The way in which the court has articulated this rule is that it is permissible for the federal government to seek to induce states to adopt certain policies through the expenditure of federal funds, but they may not coerce the states. And I guess, frankly, what I was looking for was whether there was any kind of clear analytic statement about how we know the difference between inducement and coercion. And my quick review of shuffling the papers suggests that this is a little bit like Justice Stewart, another great Ohioan, his view of pornography, that the difference is something you know when you see it. But I think partly what motivated the majority, and the majority, of course, here included two of the liberal justices on the Medicaid provision, was both the size of the state, the amount of the state budget that was implicated in this, and also the fact that the funds that were being threatened were funds that had already been committed to the state under another set of conditions, that this seemed to have a kind of retroactivity to it. Hypothetically, of course, Congress could say, okay, we now hereby repeal the entire Medicaid statute, and now we reenact it as a single integrated program, and you have to, you know, buy in or not. Politically, that's not going to happen. This is the line between encouragement and coercion is still left pretty fuzzy.
In a way, Mike Thompson, by eliminating that mandate for the Medicaid expansion, that's doing, in some ways, at least in the short term, the Obama administration or the Obama reelection a little bit of a favor, because they can't be out there saying the federal government's blackmailing the states, as Attorney General Mike DeWine referred to it.
Yeah, there is uncertainty here what exactly this means for states as far as Medicaid and the whole unfunded mandates. They can trot that out. But you're right. It's the government is, the Supreme Court has said the federal government can't force the state's hand on this stuff. So it's up to the states to do this. And that's what Mitt Romney has been advocating for. That's what Republicans have been advocating for on the overall health care law, you know, trying to explain Medicaid, the nuances of Medicaid law and Medicaid financing
during a campaign stop.
Yeah. And that's why every Republican statement we are getting has three words on it. Middle class tax hike, or four words, sorry. Middle class tax hike. So that's what they're going to beat on over the next 4 months.
And conversely, that's a favor to the Republicans, yeah, turning it into a tax. Peter Shane, folks were saying that either way, this is going to be a monumental decision. Mm-hmm. But is it more monumental if they would have struck the whole law down or not?
That's, of course, a very, very good question. We do have 5 votes on the court for a restrictive view of the Commerce Clause that basically regards what Congress did here as forcing participation in the market as being beyond the economic reach of Congress. You know, mandates have been part of the law nearly forever. The very first Congress required ship owners to buy insurance for their seamen. Now, the ordinary response to that is, but you didn't have to go into the business of being a ship owner. So it's not coercive in that sense. So the question really is, so this sounds like, again, this sounds like a limitation on the Commerce Clause, but how many other I would ask, is it politically plausible that there are any number or any other human activities that Congress would seek to regulate in this same way? And if the answer is no, I mean, if this was the target of opportunity in terms of social policy and it has now been upheld, then the limitation in principle on the Commerce Clause that was articulated by five justices in the case may not really have any practical limitation on what Congress can accomplish, other than the case that I mentioned before, which is conservatives very much want to make sure that Congress does not impose requirements on state programs of public education, even though it's unquestionable that public education has an impact on interstate commerce.
Mike Thompson.
I just think kind of a reality check here. It's June, what, 29th, 28th? What, I forgot what day it is. I just came off vacation, so I'm kind of lost. Anyway, July 4th is next Wednesday. This is the time where people tune out. And this will dominate the news for the next couple of weeks, maybe not even that long, for the next week, when many folks are on vacation. But soon, the campaign will swing back to the number one issue by far, and that's the economy. This is a victory for the Obama administration, a big victory for them, you could say, much like the death of Osama bin Laden was. But this will, the hype over this, the euphoria that Democrats are feeling, the angst that Republicans are feeling of this will pass, and it will again, the campaign will come back to jobs and the economy, and that will decide this election.
I saw that within the first hour after the decision was made today, or this decision was revealed today, Mitt Romney raised something like $300,000, which, you know, they're raising a ton of money anyways, but there is that.
It's a rallying cry for that conservative base.
And so when you're the losers, quote unquote, you're going to it tends to generate more wealth that way.
My guess is the email boxes of Democrats have also been filled with emails from the Democrats and from the Obama campaign saying, we won, give us money. So both sides will play that game.
You have been listening to a special All Sides with Dan Fisher today. Once again, just want to go over what has occurred. The Supreme Court upholds most of President Obama's Affordable Health Care Act. The Supreme Court has upheld the individual insurance requirement at the heart of President Barack Obama's health care overhaul in a 5-4 ruling. The court this morning rejected that Congress went too far in requiring most Americans to have health insurance or to pay a penalty. We have heard from the president. We've heard from Mitt Romney, his GOP challenger for the presidential office in November. Also with us today, Peter Shane of the Ohio State University's Moritz College of Law. Peter, thanks for joining us today. We really appreciate it.
Oh, it's been a pleasure.
And Mike Thompson, thanks for sitting in with us as well.
Absolutely. You're welcome.
And thanks to everybody who joins us today. Thanks to the All Sides staff. Associate producer Linda Amy Jurovich, All Sides intern Corinne Gleckler, All Sides volunteers Rachel Ramey and Andrew Sweet, with video production by Rich and Amber Karsmiski. Thanks to everybody for all of your help today, and thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher. This is WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, streaming online at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, a service of WOSU Public Media.